It is Saturday, March 17th, 2012. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we'll cover geek news. In the second half, we'll be speaking with author and manga artist Mark Crilly. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the second half of the show, I'll be inviting author and writer Mark Crilly. He's known for many things, but his YouTube channel is how I found him. We'll be talking about how his career has worked as a comic artist and about his new books. But first, in the first half, we'll be doing some geek news. And in the air with me, I have station manager and geek extraordinaire, Terry Green. Terry, welcome.
Thank you. I've never been referred to as a geek extraordinaire, to the best of my knowledge. I'm honored.
Well, when there's someone in my life that I can go, well, he knows the answer to these 15 technical things, like the radio spectrum, basically, which is a clever use of the word spectrum, you're the person I think of. So, in my mind, very much an expert.
Well, thank you
for being here. We'll talk a little bit about politics and NPR and technical issues as well in just a minute. First, I want to invite also Charlie Mansky. Hi, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Now, you've been on before. Actually, both of you have been on before. Charlie, you produce Dr. Dawn, and thank you so much for being here this morning with me.
You're welcome.
So the first thing that actually you sent an email to me a couple days ago, Terry, to talk about This American Life story a while ago about the Foxconn plant that makes iPads. And they had a guest performance artist come on and talk a lot on the show. And when we covered the topic on Geek Speak, Al Luckow was with me that day. And he's knows some people in the industry. He's friends with Woz, for example. Right. And his perspective on it was that the working conditions weren't very bad at Foxconn. And we started to try to talk about that on air. And I kind of cut him off because my perspective was, wait, this is a hot political issue. We don't really know what we're talking about. And I was in this space of didn't want to slap down somebody's reporting of abuses. We talked about the abuse issue, right, of whether people are being taken advantage of all this wonderful tech we have. And since then, I think I've been thinking a lot about trying to reuse technology more than get new technology, because there's always a downside to the new tech. So now, what's the story about this American Life story?
So it emerges that Al was not the only listener to This American Life whose personal experience was possibly at odds with Mike Daisy's story. Mike Daisy's the name of the performer that you referred to. He has hosted a one-man show, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs, for quite a while. It's currently playing in New York. And he appeared on This American Life in January to do what was essentially a radio version of his one-man show. And that program was heard by, among other people, Rob Schmitz, who is the China-based correspondent for another show that runs on KUSP called Marketplace.
Right.
And kind of like Al's experience, Rob, as a China-based reporter, you know, a lot of reporting on the economy, talks about tech when you're reporting on China. And Rob's experience was at odds in some specifics with parts of the story that were presented as fact when it aired on This American Life. One of the things that stuck in particular in Rob's mind was an element of the story was talking about workers who were poisoned by one of the solvents that's used in production of
the glass,
consumer electronics. Yeah, right. It's called N-hexane.
Right.
And the poisoning case was a significant story in China. And Rob,
he covered it. Actually.
Rob was aware of it. What Rob was aware of was that it happened 1,000 miles away from where Mike Daisy says it happened as part of his monologue.
And interesting, these are like flags that happen for journalists. Like, wait a second, that story doesn't match with facts, and therefore, wait, you can't do that, right? It's a difference between performance art and journalism.
Exactly so. And if one one of the things that the journalists tend to, the way journalists often think, is if one thing is wrong, is this the only thing that is wrong?
Exactly.
So Rob, in his job as a correspondent, did additional digging and was able to find multiple places where the account in This American Life couldn't be, couldn't be verified, you know, using his reporter techniques. So where things get particularly interesting is that he went to This American Life with, you know, with what he was learning, and This American Life embraced the idea of exploring this further.
Yeah.
Rather than approaching this in a from a sort of defensive posture, which is really, you know, pretty common when one journalist challenges another journalistic organization.
Well, it's
they got very, you know, very interested in the idea of trying to really get to the bottom of this if they had been misled.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, the story in general is great because we have this creepy fascination with Apple's tech or anything that's new and shiny and does amazing things, right?
Right.
We do that in the society very well. In fact, I think right now people are lined up for the new iPad. And right now Charlie is getting, you know, reading up on some stuff right now with an iPad, right? They're kind of invasive in our life. I've got a Mac in front of me as well.
Right.
But it's interesting that visceral experience of touching an iPad for the first time and moving apps around and playing, you know, that bird game. You know, there's a lot of things that occur to you emotionally that you don't actually understand exactly, right?
Exactly.
It feels a bit like a kid in a toy shop. And so then to hear a negative side is a very, you know, it's exactly the kind of story that This American Life likes. That kind of, oh, by the way, surprise, and this is more important to you than you think. That whole effect is extremely, extremely good story.
Ira has often said when he's done his one-man show about producing the radio program that the element of surprise is one of the most important things about storytelling in general and about This American Life in particular.
Absolutely.
So the consequence of all of this is that yesterday, coincidentally, the day that retail sales started for the new iPad, yesterday morning, This American Life put out a news release that retracted the entire program that aired in January, explained, you know, what we've essentially said, and announced that the show this week, which will air on KUSP the first time tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, and then it'll repeat the next Friday evening at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
That story will be, that program will be devoted to, as Ira put it, to an autopsy of the story that they killed, to understand what really happened. Additionally, if people want to find out more about this, there was a very good piece that Rob Schmitz did on Marketplace last night on KUSP, which you can hear at marketplace.org. And David Folkenflik from NPR News did a story about it that aired this morning on Weekend Edition Saturday.
So we're covering it well. Yeah.
It's become a very significant story.
Within
the world of tech and within the world of media reporting.
And it touched me, of course, because when we started talking about this on GeekSpeak, Al's perspective was not the current flow of, you know, media understanding what was going on. And I kind of was like, wait, I don't want to be in this space where we're promoting something that potentially is wrong, right?
And so particularly against the flow of other credible news organizations.
Yeah, yeah. And you can listen to the shows a couple episodes ago up at geekspeak.org. It's very clear that I just kind of stopped the conversation and move on. And I think it's appropriate to do that when you don't know enough information about something. But it was really telling afterwards for Al to say, it was fine for you to stop me on this because we didn't know enough. But by the way, look at this.
Yeah, yeah. Incidentally.
It's a very learning experience. I really find it fascinating to be in that space, in this media space, right, where we think about very strongly how what we say affects things. There's this amazing, and we could have Don on to talk about this ability of the human brain to misremember facts continually, right? You'll hear something like that Foxconn's doing bad things to the employees on the radio. Then you'll hear the retraction and the whole story. And what you'll remember 3 years from now is that Foxconn was doing something wrong, right? So it's like, it's a very difficult thing to try to correct something. And, you know, 800,000 people or something like that have listened to that story.
800,000 downloads of the podcast, which is the most in the history of This American Life, in addition to at least 200,000 people listening to it, you know, as a live stream the first week, plus, you know, the normal radio audience for This American Life, the old fashioned way over over a local radio station, which is, you know, another, you know, 1.5 million people.
And this, you know, this is definitely a media discussion. It's not exactly a technical thing. I wanted to touch base because I feel like I want to try to support the retraction aspect of it. Charlie, did you?
And the one thing too, this morning, the report when I heard about this on my drive in, was the really good reaction that they had on This American Life, and that they were accepted responsibility and to do this special show. They owned up to it, and I thought that was extremely impressive.
Yeah.
I don't hear that in a lot of other places, you know, news sources. You know,
it's interesting because, of course, Ira Glass is a, you know, as regular listeners to NPR that we are, or public radio in general, Ira Glass is somebody that we, you know, generally respect. You know, it's mm-hmm. easy to respect him. He's got this wonderful quality to pull in interesting stories. He always hosts his show in this warm way. I just, you know, inherently, I like him, right?
Exactly.
So to see his write-up in the lead-up to the press release and then the press release in general, he's quoted, it means a lot how much he feels good reporting, how important that is to him.
Exactly. They asked directly, you know, is this kind of a show entertainment or is this really supposed to be good news reporting? And they definitely said it's supposed to be the latter.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it's supposed to be, you know, good, hard, you know, news, but accurate and
a
responsible.
A good story is extremely important to that, of course. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I mentioned when I wrote about this yesterday on my blog here at the station that one of the things about This American Life is that it uses both fiction and fictionalized storytelling as well as journalism, but they're very good at drawing bright lines around each.
Mm-hmm.
So as you listen to This American Life, you know what parts of the story are, you know, actual, you know, journalism-based reporting and what parts are storytelling that is fictionalized. And
right.
You know, and that puts them in a particularly vulnerable spot when part of their journalism turns out to be badly sourced.
Absolutely. Then their story has no credibility. It's very damaging. Yeah. Well, that's what happens. That story is what happens when information goes out that's actually potentially wrong, and there's a correction. That process that we do in media. There's another aspect that's happening on the internet is the control of media. You know, we've all heard of the Great Firewall of China, a wonderful term for the governmental modification and minimalism of the communication flow on the internet from China, and A bid went out yesterday. Pakistan is asking for a filtering system, a great wall of firewall of Pakistan. And the discussion that I was reading up on CNET is a wonderful article by Charles Cooper talking about how companies have to, you know, large companies like Cisco are saying, oh, we're not doing that. We're not helping the Pakistani government subjugate the information that goes to the internet, right? We're not doing that. And I find it interesting that this technical ability for large filtering systems, URL filtering, which we have in companies all the time in the U.S. It's a very common thing. In fact, Miles Elam, one of the regular geeks, worked for a company for a while that did filtering for corporate-level stuff. The general idea is you want to be able to manage and control what kind of traffic goes over your network and what kind of responsibility U.S. companies have to not supply that to regimes that might be potentially damaging their population, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting... I have this perspective that, yeah, information should be free. You know, like I really feel strongly about that. At the same time, when people put up, you know, articles about, do you have any feeling, Terry, and Charlie, you can ask this too. Personally, I'm okay with all information being available. It's okay for me if people know how to make bombs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Anarchist Cookbook. That should be available to everybody.
Right.
And that's a general feeling from a liberal upbringing probably.
Yeah.
But at the same time, some people feel that's a little dangerous to let that information be available. What's your thought?
I was something very close to a First Amendment absolutist before tech changed this dialogue completely.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, for better or worse, my personal history is very much in alignment with, you know, what I think is kind of the conventional worldview among geeks, which is that information really needs to be free, and restrictions on information as information should be minimal if they exist at all. You know, which is very different from saying, you know, restrictions on conduct. You know, but the flow of information. I mean, I have a very deep bias towards freedom of information,
sure,
and in that sense, I'm
well,
probably,
that's probably why you're in public radio, right?
I think that's exactly right. That a lot of that way of thinking, you know, influenced all the career decisions that I made.
Yeah.
But
is there anything you think any information that shouldn't be available to everybody?
It's hard for me to think of any specifics that you know in terms of an open utility, which the open internet is. I mean, we're not talking about what happens inside a business or inside a household, but when you look at the internet as the internet, I can't think of, you know, of any place where, you know, where I would say this type of information as information should be blocked.
Yeah, we saw some feedback from one of the things, reasons why this story is interesting from a technical perspective as well, that this the filtering of Pakistan internet right. traffic is that Global Network Initiative, which is a co-founded by Google, Microsoft, and Yahoo, so large corporate, right. you know, large internet corporate supported group, also AccessNow.org, have urged tech companies not to respond to this Pakistan request. Mm-hmm. Right, so they're saying very clearly, these large tech companies right. are saying, don't do this, don't support information blocking, mm-hmm. and that's always interesting. When we had the Stop Online Piracy Act, right. These companies also stepped forth and said, "No, right. don't do this." And that political strength of these large media companies is, I feel, yeah, great. That's good because we don't want to block Pakistani information. But at the same time, they're making large, outspoken. Google's voice on the internet, for example, is very powerful.
Very definitely.
And as they make stands on things, it's important to note that they have a stand, right? That they have right. an initiative and a motive. It might be in line right now with me, but it might not later be in line.
And it's also, and I think you know, a lot of people who cover tech have at least thought about this.
Point, sure.
That. For an information utility like Google or Yahoo,
that seems like a good thing for them to want.
It's
open.
A very good thing to want from the standpoint of perpetuating the business that you're
right.
in.
The more people read and go online, the more ads get served
right.
by Google.
The
right?
fewer yeah. people are blocked from something, the better the chance that the dominant player in that something sure. will accomplish what they're set out to do.
If Pakistan does do a good job of putting a firewall up and blocks their traffic mm-hmm. out, and they produce a Google competitor in Pakistan, Google's no longer as functional there, right?
It's that much smaller a potential market.
Well, it's an interesting issue, and I'm back and forth in a corporate environment if a mm-hmm. corporation should be able to restrict when a flow goes on a right. computer. And that even right there to me is a little concerning. Mm-hmm. I'd rather that a company trust their employees to do the appropriate things. Mm-hmm. But now in this age where there's extremely fast backlash to anything that happens bad, one employee tweeting something internally to a company can damage a company's profit line. Mm-hmm. It definitely is a concerning place to be. You right. want to kind of control what's said about the company you're in. Anyway, the interesting topic. Well, of course, all the stuff we talk about on GeekSpeak, there's lists of leaks and all that and more discussion online at geekspeak.org. Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
Hi. So we're not connected digitally, so I don't know what your story is, but please tell us.
Oh, am I supposed to have a story?
Oh, well, okay. you look like you were ready.
I've been looking for a story. Well, I was just reading about Firefox 12 beta. Is yep. that Aurora? And it looks pretty cool. It's a lot more support for developers, apparently. So
now
that's
used
worth
to program.
Checking out.
You used to program Mozilla. You were a programmer for
yeah,
Mozilla.
Yeah, I worked for Netscape, and so I have some code, you know, a few lines of code probably buried in there somewhere.
Right.
I worked for the composer, so it was mainly more of the...
The
email program, you know, uses Composer. So if you use Thunderbird, you're using a lot of stuff I wrote. Yeah,
that's great. Yeah, that's wonderful. In browser stories, Speedy is getting moved along. You guys know what Speedy is?
I don't know what Speedy is.
Oh, Speedy's pretty cool. A while ago, so the HTTP spec, the definition of how communication on the internet works. When you type in your website, you're going through HTTP. There's a few things around that. The spec that we currently use are HTTP 1.1, I believe. And there are some problems with the way that traffic flows between sites. So if you, Terry, are a website, and I say, hey, I want kwsp.org, and you say, here's the HTML document for right. kwsp.org, inside that document is going to be all these images mm-hmm. and JavaScript files and CSS right. files. So after I get that whole file, then I parse it and look at it. Then I can start asking you again for, hey, I need this image and this image and this mm-hmm. image. And all of those are handshake protocols of the HTTP right. spec, and all that has overhead. Mm-hmm. So what the Chromium group has done, which is a Google initiative to some degree, has said, well, wait a second. Why don't we let the server say, here's the web page you want and meta information at the same time that says, and here's some other things you're probably going to want. So, and actually, let's set up a paradigm where we actually package all that up to you on the first request and give everything to you. And that's kind of what Speedy is. I am glossing over drastically how it works. But it's in the Chromium browser, the Chrome browser now and derivatives, and Google's using it for, I think, all of their content. Mm-hmm. So if you use Chrome for Google, you actually are having a speedier experience than the underlying protocol can support for Safari or Internet Explorer. Chrome's going to be faster. Now, the reason I mentioned it is because Firefox 11, the current one, actually has Speedy in it enabled disabled by default. I think 12 is going to have it enabled by default. So it's another protocol that's kind of emerging because large companies created it, right? And it will probably be initiated into the HTTP spec. But I just think it's a cool way of improving this the speed. And I, the general HTTP spec worked fine, and now we have so much content for every page, so many different files, if
right.
you will.
Yeah. And it points out that it's helpful to actually think about how something is being used, and
right.
and how the dynamic of online communication is evolving, as you build these basic tools, whether
sure.
it's a web browser or whatever.
And other server side technologies, I think Twitter just updated their service to now support Speedy as well. So you'll see mm-hmm. it grow on the server side as well. It is actually kind of a complicated thing to do on the server side because mm-hmm. you have to do a lot more understanding of the content you're delivering
right.
than a normal HTTP server would do.
I actually have a useful comment in this
yeah.
regard. I'm hoping that this will improve the response you have when you're using these dish satellite ISPs, so that, like Dish Network or Direct PC, because a lot of people don't realize is while the streaming video speed for those connections is pretty good, and that's basically what they advertise, get, as fast as DSL or something like that, there's this HTTP request delay,
yep.
which kills the functionality of those. And so it can really seem very, very slow if you go to like a banking site, which mm-hmm. is very, very complicated interface with many, many, many different little pieces.
And every one of those is a new initial.
A new initial. Yeah. Because of the simple fact the satellite is 25,000 miles away, you do the math and it's like, I think it's like a third of a second,
yeah,
right. which is a long time when you're trying to gather a whole lot of pieces of information.
Yeah.
And so I find that it was really, really painful, and I recently dropped it entirely. I was using
it
as kind of a backup.
Streaming? How is it for streaming something like
that? Once
YouTube
you get
video?
That connection,
yeah.
So if you get a YouTube connection, it would be like okay. You
yeah.
know? Yeah. It still wasn't great.
Now you've gone through a phone delivery.
Yeah, I'm using the Verizon, method, and it's just 3G. We don't have 4G yet, and it's actually quite good.
So you're not using wireline at all. Or satellite.
I don't have any choice.
Right.
I'm not using satellite, or I'm not using. We don't have DSL available or cable where I live. Believe it or not.
Hey, volunteers will play a vital role in the next KOSP membership drive, which starts Wednesday, March 28th. If you can help take pledge calls, please call 1-800-655-5877 or send us a note through the contact section at KOSP.org. Thanks. It's actually a lot of fun to volunteer at KOSP. You get to meet some of the faces of the voices you know so well, and we can really use the help.
Good snacks, too.
Good snacks?
Good snacks.
That's so true.
We work very hard on pledge drive food at KOSP.
Yeah, I agree. It's always a good day to come in with all the liveliness happening, too. Hey, Mark Crilley is an American comic book creator and child's book author and illustrator. He's the creator of Miki Falls, Akiko, and Brody's Ghost. He's also noted for his structural videos for drawing in the manga style on YouTube. His new book is Mastering Manga with Mark Crilley. And Mark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Mark, I know your voice so well because I have been watching for about 2 years these wonderful how-to-draw videos of yours online. And that YouTube experience has allowed me to start learning your work. And so I went and bought your Miki Falls collection. And though it's a teen novel, I would say, my six-year-old and seven-year-old are fascinated by it. They love it. And
well, thanks, first of all, for your support. I really appreciate it, and I'm delighted that your kids are enjoying it. I definitely tried to make it something that could appeal to people of all ages.
You went to art school. Can you tell me a little bit about your experience of becoming a professional artist?
Yeah, well, actually, I went to a liberal arts college called Kalamazoo College here in Michigan, and I majored in art. And I was very lucky to take classes with a children's book author and illustrator, David Small, who became kind of a mentor to me. And I think, I had always loved drawing, but I really think it was David who helped lift me up to a higher level and get me to take myself more seriously.
I recall one of your YouTube videos describing the process of learning to draw. And I want to talk with you just a second. First, I'm going to let Terry, you've got lots of things to do to get ready for the pledge drive, right?
Right. One of the first things that happens in the pledge drive is that KUSP's leadership circle gets phone calls from members of the board of directors reminding them how important their support is. Charlie is a member of our board of directors, so he's supposed to be making those calls, and I'm supposed to be planning everything so people know who to call.
Well, Charlie Mansky and Terry Green, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak today with me.
Thank you, Lyle.
Thank you.
See you soon. All right, back to art and comic books. Very geeky stuff. Mark, so you're one of the things that you showed in your one of your videos was a collection of the work you'd done as you learned as a student.
Right, yeah. I like bringing my YouTube audience into my life as an artist whenever I can, showing drawings from the past and so forth. I think a lot of them, unfortunately, are comparing themselves maybe to me. I'm 45 years old. I've been at this for decades, you know. So I think I need to remind them, hey, guys, you know, you've got years ahead of you. Don't be discouraged if you're not able to draw the way you see me drawing in these videos.
Yeah, I mean, that's an extremely important thing. I grew up in an artistic family. My mother's an artist. And one of the things we had in our home is a lot of paper, a lot of art supplies, and this understanding that there was no real judgment of how the quality was, which I think is a very good thing to do when you're starting out. One of the tacks you've taken is you have a very different style on describing how to draw. Instead of saying anything can be right, which was the experience I had, and I think most people have in art school, you kind of say, hey, this is how I'm going to do it. And you can emulate that and draw the same kind of drawing. One of the early on, your manga eyes imagery, I decided to relate that back to my kids and taught them how to draw one of the styles of your eyes, if you will. And in doing that, it was very different than how I was taught to draw and interact with art. And it worked quite well in that they were able to look back and go, look what I did. They were so excited about having a style that felt very, I don't know, mature as an artist.
Yeah. I think my approach is pretty unorthodox, and it may not be, something that art instructors would approve of necessarily, but I'm doing just as you have said there. I'm giving young beginning artists a sort of shortcut by which they can leapfrog to a good final result and give them that confidence and get them drawing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, and in doing this, you show your very experienced hand drawing multiple things. You know, people basically submit to your YouTube channel, you know, I want to know how to draw feet better. I want to know how to draw clothing. Can you please teach us? And you'll do a couple drawings kind of talking about why you're doing it and narrating the entire time what you're doing. Sometimes there's some time-lapse stuff where it goes a little faster. But the actual image that you're producing is clearly a very talented, skilled hand. And I think us as, you know, watchers are just copying you. You know, it feels that way quite a bit. But there is something to say about being proud about a piece of work you've done. I recall one of the how to draw comics from years ago from my childhood in the early 80s. There was I think I might have traced it. Maybe I didn't trace it. I just copied it very closely. And after, I was so proud of that drawing for so long. It made me feel like, oh, I can definitely attempt that. It just takes skill and effort. It takes, you know, effort. But it was wonderful in copying you over and over again and seeing what you're doing and watching other people's comments about it and response videos of people doing it to see then you pull out your portfolio and go, hey, guys, it's a lot harder to learn how to do this than you think. You know, there's a lot to do here. So I appreciated that. I really wanted to talk to you. I mean, in your book, of course, this is the perfect content for radio, right? We're talking about drawing and art on the radio. Of course, we have our podcasts and stuff. You can find your stuff on YouTube. But what I really wanted to chat with you about was your experience of how YouTube has modified your career. And like, I didn't know about your long history with Akiko, the comic book series that has something like 50 books. Is that correct?
Yeah, 53 issues of the traditional comic book series, you know, the sort of floppy comics that we all grew up with.
Yeah. And you've been doing this since, I guess you started that in the 80s, and or into the 90s, mid-90s, you did that whole series. I didn't know anything about it until I get your book, and that's the way that the publisher is promoting you, from the creator of Akiko, right? Which, of course, for me, it's like from the artist on YouTube. You know, that's how I think of you. So how did you do so successfully with this long series of Akiko? Did that flow into you being successful on YouTube, or are they completely different spaces?
Well, you know, what happened is I came to realize that these days an author's responsibility goes beyond creating the book to promoting the book to some degree. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get the word out about your books, you are in danger of them not selling enough that you can even allow to do this as your job. So I turned to YouTube initially just to help get the word out about what was then my latest series, Miki Falls. And I think what happened is these instructional videos began to get more and more attention, and my purpose for being on YouTube gradually changed from simply hyping my books, which I wonder how many people would want to sit around and listen to that all day, to genuinely, you know, trying to pass on what I've learned and give people these little tricks and tips that I've been handing out to help them improve their own drawing skills.
I love that you did initially start trying to promote your book. I think that people do that quite a bit. But, of course, you produced content on YouTube, which is completely different than anything you could do in a print form, these drawing videos. Just to give some numbers for people, how many people are actually... You have 500,000 subscribers on your channel, which means that 500,000 people in the world have accounts on YouTube, and when you release a new video, they get notified of it. 88, or almost 89 million views of your videos have happened, right? This is the YouTube stats, right? Really simple to look up.
Yeah.
Kind of amazing. I mean, if you were selling 500,000 books, you'd be pretty happy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a very different space. Of course, this content's for free.
Absolutely, and you know, the other thing about it is how YouTube spills across international boundaries. So I'm seeing comments from people in Norway and people in Indonesia and all over the place. So it really, just as you said, it has stunned me as much as anyone the degree to which this took off. In the early days, I was happy to get 1,000 views on a video, and now it can go as high as a million or more.
Miki Falls is a four-volume graphic novel. It's in manga style. We should probably talk a little bit about manga style. It has a strong female lead narrative from her perspective, her journey. It's titled The Four Seasons, basically, right? And how was this book doing prior to you being successful on YouTube? This series?
Well, the two of them kind of came about at the same time. And so Miki Falls was not able to fully benefit from this YouTube work. You know, Miki Falls was coming out. I saw that it was just about to come out, and that's when I started to do the videos. And so my very newest series, Brody's Ghost, is maybe the one that is more benefiting from having established myself that way. But it certainly has allowed Miki Falls to stay in print and to bring it to the attention of people around the world who surely would never have heard of it otherwise.
I wouldn't have bought Miki Falls. You know, if I had gone into a comic book store, which I do constantly actually, and seen Miki Falls, I wouldn't have picked it up. I've really never read drama-based manga stuff, right? I read, I think, a lot of action superhero type stuff. I'm a guy, right? That's what we normally pick up. Friends pass them off to me. Right. And I also do a lot, I read a lot about comic book creation. So for me, the YouTube videos were much more interesting. And as I watched your style, I really wanted to see what your narrative was like, what your writing style was like. It's not extremely, I mean, it's common, but not always the case that the artist and the writer are the same person, which in your case it is. What's wonderful about the Miki Falls series is it's a really charming, magical, fun story. It's and scary and sad.
Well, thank you for saying so. You know, I wouldn't blame people for being a little doubtful at first, you know, when they see me talking about Miki Falls on my videos and thinking, oh boy, who is this guy trying to sell his books? Is he really any good beyond just being a guy who teaches on YouTube? And it always pleases me when someone like yourself reads the book and is maybe pleasantly surprised. Hey, this guy does know how to tell a story, and there's something to this, you know. So thanks for saying that. I'm delighted that you enjoyed it.
Well, it's interesting because one of the reasons I decided to buy the series was how much time and energy I'd taken watching your videos. Right? It was not exactly like I want to read the story because I know it's going to be amazing. I thought, you know, he's been doing all this work. He's got his artwork. I'm not supporting him in any way, really. I should buy a book, you know? And so I bought the first one, and I then lost it quickly because the kids took it. And then I was like, you know what? I'll just get them all. And sure enough, it's been a little fun thing. And since this is in the home and my girls are seeing it, you know, they're seeing this strong female lead, I really appreciate. Now looking back at seeing some write-ups about Akiko, also a strong female lead. I think the Wikipedia page for Akiko was something I wanted to go ahead and read the intro. I loved it. The story has been described as a cross between The Wizard of Oz and Star Wars, centering on Akiko, a Japanese-American girl, on and around the planet Smoo. So to give you everybody a perspective on that book a little bit, it sounds like it's going to be also surprising and fun, and I look forward to getting that. But let's call and talk about Brody's Ghost. Would you have gotten published for Brody's Ghost if it weren't for your YouTube experience?
I think I may have found a publisher for it eventually, but it certainly contributed to Dark Horse, which is, you know, the number three, I think, comic book publisher in America. It contributed to them, I think, moving forward with it, seeing that I had my own audience. What you described there, your experience, I often find myself on the other side of that as someone who listens to podcasts, uh-huh. say. And I get into that same place where I'm like, I feel a connection to these people, and so why don't I donate or whatever? Why don't I help them out? And I think you and I are witnessing the birth of a new way of doing things where the creative people are not necessarily up in an ivory tower somewhere. They are actually out communicating with people on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And I think Brody's Ghost has dovetailed nicely with that, and I see it almost as the future. You know, we all of us have to get out there and connect with the people, establish these personal connections with our readers.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Mark Curley. He's an author and artist in the manga style of art. Comic books, and very published, well-known on YouTube. You can find a whole bunch of his wonderful how-to-draw style stuff on YouTube, a very successful channel. And we're chatting about his books, his artwork, and the like. We're not taking calls today on Geek Speak. I could invite people to call. We'll think about it. Let's talk about the manga style in general. I think everybody in the American population knows the Batman and Superman and Spider-Man style of comic books because we use that imagery all the time. The older style, the kind of golden age superhero space, and the newer style, which is a lot darker, a lot more ink, basically. That is not manga. Can you describe manga?
Well, yeah, it is a tricky thing to put across, but I think even the casual viewer may recognize it. I think the first thing people tend to notice are these big, shiny eyes. You know, the characters have very large eyes. I think there's a spiky hair. We're seeing more and more of its influence. A few years back, there was the show Teen Titans, that cartoon show. Or the cartoon show version Avatar. I think these Western shows have been influenced by the manga or anime style. And so maybe that's the way that people are going to recognize that style. Like I said, the big eyes, I think there's a certain way of conveying emotions in a humorously exaggerated way. A lot of American comic book readers will recognize the use of speed lines, these repeated motion lines.
When a superhero is jumping, there seems to be the air around them kind of trails along to define where they're moving.
Yeah, there's this whole series of conventions that come from the so-called manga style. I think, you know, the people who really love it say, but there is no one manga style. There are many of them. How dare you try to reduce it to a single style? And it's true. They have a point. There are dozens upon dozens of variations.
You know it
when you see it, right?
Yeah, I guess so. One of the things I hadn't really thought about until reading your book was the inking style. When just to give everybody kind of a definition of this, as you draw a comic book, there's a lot of different steps. The first thing to do is kind of lay it out. You normally draw it in pencil, and then later, sometimes different artists actually will come in with ink, and the ink, adding the ink to it, it changes the effect quite a bit from that loose sketching kind of effect that you'll see with pencil to a very clear, crisp line, which of course then can be Xeroxed, or not Xeroxed anymore, but printed in a really effective way. And that's the reason why it happens. So comic books traditionally have the artist, an author, and an inker, and all of those roles are extremely important. In manga, I guess the style of inking is normally thin line, which is not what you see in like an American traditional action comic.
Yeah, I think I noticed that there in American comics there tended to be a certain brushiness or an emphasis on varying width of line, and the really skilled comic creators were almost showing off how they could use the brush to lay the ink in quite thick in some areas and very thin in other areas. And again, it's dangerous to generalize, but I saw quite a lot of manga illustrations where the emphasis seemed to be on a uniformity of line and relatively thin in terms of the width of the line. So it's interesting to see the different looks in terms of the nuts and bolts of the process.
So besides your instructor at art school, who influences you in who are you impressed with in the art or in the comic world?
Wow, well, you know, someone that I fell in with early on was Jeff Smith, the creator of Bone, and Stan Sakai, the creator of Usagi Yojimbo. Have you seen those comics?
Bone is a staple of our home, absolutely. And Jeff Smith's Bone series, the new work by, who's the publisher that produced it in these wonderful graphic volume form?
Is that the Scholastic version?
The Scholastic version is color and durable. Durable is very important when you've got a lot of kids around, right?
Right.
And it's wonderful. These books are, they're in the shelves all the time, and they're mostly out of the shelves, right? So that Bone's been a big... That was the first hit for my kids to experience comic books was the Bone series. Absolutely.
And I think his influence remains with me in terms of a story that can reach all ages without having the so-called kiddie feeling to it, that has a wide variety of tones to it in terms of the storytelling and can be taken seriously. That's what I'm always striving for, without profanity, without too much blood and things like that. So, yeah, Jeff has been a big guiding force for me that way.
Yeah, I think that's very important, and you notice that. I notice that in your work as well. There is a tendency in our culture to do sensationalism and take it to the highest, you know, insanity level or action-packed 13-year-old boys' experience level in comics. It's a very common, I think that's what people see in their mind when they think about comics. So to read a story like Bone, which is this wonderful adventure story and family story, Bone, you got to read Bone. If you haven't read Bone, go to a comic shop, say, hey, I heard about Bone, and just pick up the whole series because you'll probably love it. Any kid will love it, definitely. It's nice to see that, you know, the most shocking and dramatic things are shocking and dramatic. There is death. There is experience of people suffering. But that is not, it's not like it's produced just for that effect, right? That's just part of the story elements. And same thing with your work. It's not like you're seeing heads explode and swords being thrown around, unless necessary.
I think what happened with the American comic book world is that they started to react against the image of comics being for kids, and they wanted so badly to prove, you know, we are not just making children's stories here. Comics can be for anyone. And the pendulum really flew all the way into the other direction, and everything became dark and gritty and very much for, like, sort of, I would say, college-aged people and older almost. And so in a weird way, when someone like Jeff Smith came along, or when I came along with Akiko, we became the Mavericks almost. Oh my goodness, you're doing an all ages comic. How strange. Or how rebellious of you to not have grittiness and darkness in the comic. So it's kind of funny the way that happened.
Are you prudish? Would you describe yourself as prudish?
Absolutely. I refuse to. No, I'm not. I'm not like that at all, but I do feel that the way my career has moved forward, and like I said, you know, I started coming out of a sort of a children's book world, that for me to cross that line into content that is not appropriate for kids puts me into a dangerous zone in terms of teachers and librarians and different people not feeling that they can hand off a copy of a Mark Crilley book of any kind to younger kids without being worried about it in terms of the content.
So you're saying that you'll damage your brand if you release something that's outside that space?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to put it quite in that way, but I do think that this is where I come from, and I think all of the things that I admire most of all, to be honest with you, are things that don't require profanity. Like, for example, The Incredibles, you know, Brad Bird's film for Pixar.
Mm-hmm.
That is a perfect film for me, and that is like some of the greatest storytelling I've ever seen.
I love that story.
There's almost no blood that I can think of. There's no swearing. You don't need it. So, I think you almost maybe asked in jest, you know, are you prudish, you know. But the truth is, the stuff that influences me, like The Incredibles or the Miyazaki films, or I always go back to Calvin and Hobbes, you know.
Yeah.
These are things that did not rely on a mature audience stuff for the storytelling. And so I honestly don't even feel like I really need it. Maybe someday.
Maybe. I think another thing that happens with the comic books industry to some degree is that you start getting a readership that as they grow, they're looking for more content. But they're used to that space, that style.
Yeah.
And so I think that occurs as well. I mean, at the same time, I would hate to see, Bone or Isagai Yojimbo change drastically into something that it's not. You know, that story is that. Those stories are those stories. So I can see the idea of it. Do you ever feel like because of your brand, you're not investigating some type of story because it doesn't fit your perception?
Well, you know, the truth is, now that we talk about this, Brody's Ghost actually delves into territory that I hadn't before.
Yeah, that's true. Right.
The plot line is giving nothing away. I think it's established so early on. The plot line involves the existence of a serial killer.
Yeah.
Right? And so the very mention of that phrase really takes me into territory I haven't been in. So by my own standards, I am starting to skate into probably more of a teen audience.
Yeah.
Always holding myself back from crossing the final line into something that would, let's just say, shock the school librarian.
Needle buckets of red, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's true. And I haven't done Brody's Ghost with my kids. I'm pulling that one back until my son's in like 13 or so. That's probably when I'll introduce that one too. So.
Yeah. No, I don't blame you. It does, by necessity, get into. But all these things are by comparison, right?
Right.
So if you compare what I'm doing to what most comic book creators are doing, it's squeaky clean, right? But if you compare it to more mainstream American storytelling that is for school-age kids, then Brody's Ghost does maybe sort of come right up to the edge of things. But, you know, the fact that Scholastic decided to do a Brody's Ghost edition shows me that they didn't feel it was crossing any line.
No, I think that librarians and teachers are very much in that space of how do I capture the interest and intention of a younger audience, you know, of our student body, without pushing them off to something that's inappropriate for them, right? So they're looking for something that's a little edgy that 10-year or 12-year-old is going to pick up and go, this is cool.
Right.
And still be, you know, still they can trust it. Yeah, Scholastic's is doing an amazing job. I really appreciate that the librarian industry, if you will, has taken on the mantle of including graphic novel type work in the library systems.
They've become the people who are most excited about it.
Yeah, which is wonderful.
They see it as a great tool of bringing in reluctant readers. And so, yeah, we've gone from a society in which you expect the librarian the librarians to look down their noses at comics, to the librarians being at the forefront of cheering them on and bringing them in and using them as the great tool that they are for getting kids into reading.
Yeah. Now, if you are not a comic book reader or understand comic books, I highly recommend you pick up Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics. That's how I got involved with comics kind of late in my life. I wasn't involved with comics until I was in my mid-20s, and a friend took me to a wonderful shop in Berkeley, and Rory Root, the owner, handed me Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics, and from that moment on, I loved comics. And mostly I try to do graphic novels. I like a complete story. We've seen a high success of the most of a wonderful series that was turned into a movie and won awards last year, which is all based off of a graphic novel, huge graphic novel. Do you know what I'm talking about?
To my mind, it wasn't truly a graphic novel, but maybe The Invention of Hugo Cabret.
Well, wouldn't you say it's a graphic novel? That's the book I'm thinking of, yes.
Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, well, absolutely.
You wouldn't
say
that's a graphic novel?
Well, it is an interesting blend. It's its own thing. It uses some aspects of graphic novel storytelling, but then it's got prose fiction, right?
Yeah.
So you have passages that are told visually. It never resorts to word balloons. So it sort of stops short of going right into what people would say, hey, this is a comic book.
Yeah.
It doesn't really have panels on one page.
Right, it has full illustrations.
Yeah, so it really is taking full advantage of both forms. And so you delve into prose fiction where, of course, you're just conjuring up these images in your mind. And then it goes into purely visual sequences of pages that put you into the story in the way that the best non-verbal sections of graphic novels will do. I'm glad that I was able to figure that out. Yeah, that is a prime example of how graphic novel storytelling has gone all the way to the Academy Awards. Basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the book that is out right now is Mastering Manga with Mark Crilly. It's a how-to-draw book about manga styles. He has a lot of other books. I highly recommend Minky Falls for any age and Brody's Ghost for a little bit older. Mark, thank you so much for being on GeekSpeak with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a blast.
All right. You can find out more about Mark anywhere online if you look for Mark Crilly, markcrilly.com, on YouTube channel Mark Crilly. And thank you so much, Mark. I'll see you online.
All right. Take care.
Take care. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. For KUSP and for GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. I'll see you next week, and I appreciate you being here. As always, you can learn more at geekspeak.org.